Welcome. This is Jay Thiemeyer with Brian Lindstrom. I want to thank Jean-Pierre and Mike and King Mensa for the first half. Brian Lindstrom is a local filmmaker who recently produced the film Finding Normal, which was a wonderful film about the mentoring program for people dealing with addiction locally. He is currently developing a project on the story of James Chassie, the person who was stomped by the Portland police. And the title of the film is Alien Boy. I'd like to ask, Brian, how did you arrive at this topic of James Chassie?
Oh, actually, Jason Renaud invited me out for coffee, and he described the case to me about what happened to Jim, and then he handed me what must have been like a 8-inch thick binder full of police documents from their investigation, which included a lot of eyewitness accounts. And the more I read, the more this discrepancy between the eyewitness accounts and the police accounts just kind of demanded my attention. And I figured that there was something, you know, more to the story. And then as I got to know more about Jim's life, a lot of themes just kind of resonated with me, including, you know, his battle with mental illness and also his involvement in the early punk rock scene in Portland in the late 70s and early 80s. And it just seemed like a project that, you know, that I should do. And also Jason and I have been friends for years and have always kind of wanted to work together, and this seemed like the perfect opportunity.
Right. Well, Finding Normal, to focus on that, it appealed to me because it was very straightforward. It was a very dramatic, easy to sensationalize topic, and yet you treated it in a very informative, straight-ahead kind of way. And I understand that the same approach is being applied to Alien Boy, that this, you are approaching this with your mind open. You're curious about to find out exactly what the circumstances were and what the truth is. And James Chassie's real story, which sounds fascinating.
Yeah, with Finding Normal, you know, my goal was really just to be a fly on the wall and to kind of get out of the way and let the dramatic process of people, like, literally, you know, fighting for their lives unfold in front of the camera. And I was very lucky that people let me in to their lives and that story, you know, could unfold in the way that it did. And I was very humbled and inspired by how people just let me in. At one point I asked, you know, someone, hey, is it okay if I film you? And he said, you know, you're the least of my worries, which I thought was a good way to look at it. His point was, you know, if he uses again and gets a dirty UA, he's back in prison. And, you know, the fact that I'm there in the corner with the camera isn't really big on his, you know, radar. But, you know, Finding Normal and Alien Boy are really different, because with Finding Normal, if I could just, you know, get the access that I was given, I felt like I could follow that story and that it would, you know, something dramatic would unfold. With Alien Boy, it's a much different situation, because I have to kind of rely on interviews rather than just being a fly on the wall and doing a kind of traditional cinema verite approach where, you know, you don't really interact with the subjects. You just let whatever happens, happens. With Alien Boy, I'm always having to ask questions and kind of create, you know, this interaction that otherwise wouldn't exist, you know, if I weren't there. Mm-hmm. But I think they're similar in the fact that I think they both have the potential of reducing stigma. You know, with Finding Normal, after so many screenings and like, you know, Cinema 21 or the Hollywood Theater or the Witzel Auditorium or the Living Room Theaters or City Hall, I can't tell you how many people would come up to me and say that they had never really experienced addiction in that way, you know. And so seeing these people, you know, with their very heartfelt struggles really kind of broke down that distance between the so-called normal audience and the subject. You know, and I think Alien Boy has the potential to do a similar thing with mental illness. You know, take away that stigma and really reveal the humanity behind the label. You know, and that's really what the goal of the film is. I really want as much as possible to bring, you know, Jim's life to the forefront so that after the film, the list of things that you would say about Jim, you know, schizophrenic who died in police custody would be way down at the bottom, you know, wonderful friend, talented musician, you know, person who liked to draw, you know, man about town, you know, all these other things would be up above. Like, you know, he would really kind of become a person for you and not just a label.
Mm-hmm. And but that wasn't what the police saw in September.
Yeah, and I think that's a big challenge that the film has, is what did the police see and how can we get their perspective? You know, and I've reached out, as has Jason and other members of the filmmaking team, to try to get, you know, the police perspective. And so far, you know, because of the gag order, we're not able to do that. And I'm hoping that at some point we'll be able to get that, because as a filmmaker, I'm not going into this with any set agenda other than I really want to try to find out what happened, mm-hmm. you know, and, you know, hopefully that we'll get some response so that we can get that police perspective in there.
Right. Can you describe the gag order for those who aren't familiar with it and what it's meant as far as you're developing the film?
Sure. Well, basically, the city attorneys mentioned our film Alien Boy as a reason that, let me read from the article here, key documents in the case should remain sealed, including internal police bureau investigation, independent police review records, records of previous disciplinary action against the officers, cell phone records, and medical records. And I guess their fear is that if these materials were released and they were included in the film, that people would see the film and then be prejudiced against the police should the people who see the film then be selected to be on the jury of this case, which, as I explain it to you, kind of sounds a little bit far-fetched. I mean, all that would have to happen would be for the city attorney to ask any potential juror, have you seen Alien Boy? And if they said yes, they could be excluded from consideration. So it seems to me that it's a pretty big stretch to think that, you know, this documentary is going to somehow, you know, prejudice the public against the police department. And it also assumes a kind of anti-police stance that I'm not taking. I really just want to kind of examine the discrepancy between police accounts and eyewitness accounts and find out where is the truth in there.
Right. It seems to me that the city is sort of shooting themselves in the foot by not providing an honest perusal of the records. And what is the possibility of the gag order being lifted?
Well, as I understand it, the gag order will be in place as long as the case, you know, hasn't been settled. And as we all know, these cases can drag on for months and years. So as far as I know, there's nothing, you know, underway right now that would, you know, relieve this gag order. So it's in place as long as the case is going forward.
Mm-hmm. What is the... people are interested in exactly what the status of the film is now.
Well, we shot 19 hours of interviews in late May, and we shot in an abandoned Quonset hut in southeast Portland, which was a lot of fun, that we transformed into our little Alien Boy studios. And now we're in the process of editing that footage. And, you know, making a documentary film like this is a bit of a journey. You shoot, and then you go through what you shot, you find out what people said, and then it kind of leads you in a different direction. You know, it's like you're always kind of figuring out what exactly is the story. And so I would imagine there's probably going to be three or four periods of shooting intensive interviews and then, you know, going through that material and finding out what the story is and going forward from there. And we hope to raise some funds so that we can shoot again in August.
Mm-hmm. Did you mentioned that there might be a clip available on the Alien Boy website that people can...
We're working toward that. We don't have it there yet. I've mm-hmm. still got to go through those 19 hours and, you know, cull all that down into a pithy 10 or, you know, 12-minute clip. Right. But we were very heartened by the responses we got during the interviews. And what was particularly poignant for me were three people with mental illness who were just able to really articulate what it's like to, you know, to be challenged with mental illness, and also what Jim's death meant to them, just in terms of a kind of personal reaction and the fear that, you know, could they be next? You know, they were able to kind of articulate what it means to have a mental illness, and also to know that perhaps, you know, you would be singled out by the police, and if your responses weren't, you know, quick enough or didn't make sense, that, you know, the situation could escalate. And it was very interesting.
Another interesting thing is the interaction between the police and the emergency medical people. I know this is something that's emerged.
Yeah, it's very confusing. The eyewitness accounts, you know, all speak to Jim's, very agitated state, and also that he was, you know, clearly hurt. And we're talking about what happened out in front of Blue Hour, the restaurant. And just as a little side note, one thing that just kind of drew me to the story were all these, like, strange little coincidences that just kind of compelled me. And one of those coincidences is that Homer Williams, the developer of the Pearl District, just happened to be eating a Blue Hour while all this went down. And it seems some kind of symbolic coincidence that would happen, since gentrification arguably played a role in this. You know, if Jim had been walking through, you know, this neighborhood perhaps 10 years ago, no one may have batted an eye, but, you know, he looks kind of severely out of place there, you know, in the present Pearl District. So, you know, that was something I thought was interesting. But another coincidence that happened is that Jim was taken to the police, you know, to jail. The jail nurse refused him admission because he seemed to be in, you know, need of medical help. And then instead of calling an ambulance or going to any of the emergency rooms that were, you know, very close by, you know, a Good Samaritan comes to mind, or, you know, anyone, any of the Emmanuel, any of the nearby ERs, the police decided to take him to Seventh-day Adventist, which you couldn't find, you know, an emergency room further away than Seventh-day Adventist. And while they were on I-84 heading east, they noticed that Jim had slumped to the side in the car, and they thought he wasn't breathing. And so at that point, instead of, I think they were at about 33rd, instead of, you know, putting the siren on and going just straight to the emergency room, they pulled off the freeway and pulled over at 33rd and Northeast Clackamas and lifted Jim out of the car and to assess, you know, his vital signs. Well, it just so happened that walking by was a salesman of AEDs. Those are the, you know, the paddles, the defibrillators that you see in airports and other places in case someone has an heart attack. And this gentleman's name is John Olson, and he said, "Hey, I've got paddles," to the police. "You know, let me go get them." And so John runs into his house, puts the paddles on Jim, and the little LCD reader says, "Do not resuscitate," meaning, you know, I would think that there wasn't even enough electrical stimulus going on in Jim's body to think that there was any chance of, you know, revitalizing him with the paddle. So anyway, these kind of strange coincidences just kind of keep cropping up in the story, and it just kind of tells me that there's something there, you know.
There are two things that concern me. One is the interaction between the police and the emergency medical people. Mm-hmm. The other is what, in the context of community policing, that these police apparently were not familiar with Jim Chassie, and yet this was his daily trek. He lived at Swindell and made this same trek every afternoon, apparently, and yet they weren't familiar with him. What a difference that would have made if they had known what his routine was and what his story was.
Yeah, if they knew who he was. And one thing that really comes across in the eyewitness accounts is just that, and it's heartbreaking to read, just the fact that there wasn't any effort to de-escalate the situation. You know, I think that, you know, if it had been more of a kind of community situation that you were describing and the officers had seen Jim walking, I think that they would probably have given him more leeway, you know, and the situation would have been de-escalated and would have been handled in a different way instead of, you know, the tragic outcome that we saw. Mm-hmm.
The interface between police and emergency medical, this is something that's confusing to me. Why they prevented, for example, the EMR people from taking Jim to the hospital outside the Blue Hour, for example.
Yeah, it is confusing. And also, AMR is part of the lawsuit, so the gag order, of course, applies to them, too. But in the transcripts that I've read, and this is really unusual, one of the AMR personnel asked Officer Humphreys to sign a release, and that is unheard of. And I asked, you know, Randy Leonard about that, and he said that he had never heard of that being done, and yet, you know, it's in the transcripts that happened in this case. And we don't know what the content of that release form is or where it is today or what it, you know, meant, but it on the surface, one could, you know, assume that it meant that AMR was saying, hey, we think this guy needs help. You're preventing us from helping him. This is on you. You know, and I'm speculating, but what else can we do without the actual documents? And then another interesting thing about, you know, that comes out of this case is at what point does a, you know, a interaction between the police and a subject cease becoming a kind of legal affair, you know, a police officer, you know, versus a potential criminal, you know, affair, and when does it become a medical situation? And as you know, Jim was refused admission to the jail because of his medical condition. The nurses wouldn't give him the okay, and they drove him then to, you know, to an ER.
Right. I want to read from the information report by the nurse in the jail, looking at Jim Chassie. At 6:15 on 9/17/06, the nursing staff was called to the booking area to evaluate the inmate. The deputy initially said, quote, "I don't think he's breathing," unquote, over the intercom system. As Sukanthi Heath and I arrived in the booking area about 30 seconds later, the deputy said, quote, "No, he's breathing now," unquote. Observed inmate through the glass window of the separation cell in the booking area. He was on the floor on his right side. A white spit sock was secured over his head. The sock was stained with at least a couple of red stains appearing to be blood. As I observed, the inmate began seizure-like activity lasting approximately 5 seconds. It consisted of a stiffening of his entire body and shaking and twitching of the extremities. When this activity subsided, the inmate was breathing and moving his head and limbs. Simultaneously, while observing this activity, the correction staff was advised that we cannot accept this inmate and that he should be taken to the hospital for evaluation. The way it's depicted is that the police just tackled James Chassie, just subdued him, that he was agitated, quote unquote. But it sounds like we've read about the 16 broken ribs, I believe, and more than 20 breaks, the punctured lung. And I hadn't read where he had, obviously, shots to the head. This was a seriously damaged person.
Yeah, and there are eyewitness accounts that describe kicks to the head. And, you know, the account you just read, the question I think we're all asking is, well, why wasn't, an ambulance called at this point? And doesn't a seizure, you know, demand that, okay, this... You know, this is not a jail situation anymore. This is a hospital situation. And instead of the police driving him to the emergency room, you know, why not bring in trained medical personnel to the site?
Right. There's obviously a need for more information, right, which the city seems to be very reluctant to release. Obvious concerns about liability. Another thing that really put me off about the city's stance was that rather than focus on the obvious something being extremely wrong with this situation, focusing on the police, what was, you know, really scrutinizing that situation, those people involved, they put it off on the mental health system, which struck me as a very cheap thing to do.
Yeah, the mental health system is, you know, much maligned, and it seems like the feeling is that, you know, anyone can say anything about it and no one's going to defend it. But if you look at Jim's life, you know, he had severe mental illness, you know, certainly from the time he was probably in his early 20s on. And yet, as far as I've been able to figure out, I think he was only hospitalized once for a very short period of time. He maintained his, you know, his dignity and his independence. And he, you know, as you said, he had that routine that he would walk. He made a life that had meaning to him. And he also, he had relationships. And I think it's important that we never forget that. You know, and you're right, there's a lot of effort to kind of blame his death on the mental health system, and yet I think Jim is a success story of the mental health system.
Mm-hmm. You know, the mental health system is getting a lot of flack these days, and they're really in my opinion, my experience are just wonderful, very professional giving people. Mm-hmm. And yeah, it's really significant that Chassie was living at the at Swindell's. You know, he lived independently.
Right. He was a member. I shouldn't say he was a member, but he attended churches nearby. Mm-hmm. You know, he had a very strong kind of inner spiritual life, and you know, he was someone who had cobbled together this life, you know, that meant so much to him, mm-hmm. and to other people.
Right. The mentioning the gentrification of the Pearl and that whole area. When I first got here in '98, this process was already underway, mm-hmm. but there were still a lot of people in Old Town sleeping on the loading docks. This is a real repository for people who are down on their luck or dealing with mental health issues, serious issues. Mm-hmm. Now with the cleansing of the area, the sanitizing or the boutiqueifying, as I call it, these people are being swept away. And yet at the same time, there are cuts to, you know, where they can receive help. Mm-hmm. And it's a really scary situation. I mean, where would... you know, where are the Jim Chassies of the future going to go?
Right. Yeah, I mean, you have Old Town and Pearl right next to each other, and there's friction there, mm-hmm. you know, and it's like, how do both coexist?
Really. And at the same time, you get this sort of licensing of the police. You get this demonizing and criminalizing of homeless people. And licensing of the police to basically clean them out. There was this march this afternoon. I didn't get all of it, but they were rallying at the North Park blocks to protest these sweeps of homeless people sleeping outside. And they're coming in. They're giving them a couple of minutes to clean out if they're sleeping under the bridges or wherever, the Burnside, Morrison, Hawthorne. And if they aren't cleaned out, if they haven't taken all their stuff with them, what they leave is destroyed, and which results historically in loss of IDs, critical stuff that right. you can't carry it all. And this is the attitude, this kind of clean sweep mentality, and it's a real, real shame.
The word sweep is used in the testimony, I believe, of Officer Humphreys describing kind of what his what he and his partner were up to that day. Now, I don't know specifically if that refers to, you know, sweeping the area of, you know, so-called undesirables, but that word is used, and, you know, is interesting to me that he chose that word.
Mm-hmm. In my own experience, I know that cops too often have the attitude that you're very less than, that you're the best thing for society is to clean you out. You're a discard, you're a blemish, get rid of you. And I see, I was hoping that Matt Davis could join us because I know he's involved with advising on the film, and I love his reporting.
Yeah, Matt has done probably more than any other local journalist in keeping this story alive. Mm-hmm. I mean, he's been fearless and persistent.
He has. It's been great. And his had a story in the last Mercury a week ago about a fella who was basically brutalized by the police, no other word for it. And there's a quote in the article, quote, "When the fireman showed up, he had to make a big plea to get to the hospital to deal with his facial wounds. The cops tried to convince the fire dudes he was fine. He was pretty effed up and was brought to the station where he was interrogated," unquote. The same kind of treatment that Chassie got.
Well, you know, it's interesting. We interviewed City Commissioner Randy Leonard. And as you know, Commissioner Leonard used to be a paramedic back in, you know, years ago. And he talked about when he was a kind of rookie paramedic going to a site, and a similar situation occurred where the police tried to kind of control the medical treatment. And the senior paramedic said, "Hey, wait a minute, this is my scene. This guy needs help." And that was something that really impressed Commissioner Leonard.
Well, there are a lot of questions. We're running out of time, but a lot of questions, and it's a shame the city is not opening up and cooperating, because this is something that people are very concerned about. It would obviously, more information would relieve people and give them more faith in the move to community, real community policing and respect for the police.
Yeah, I think all we're really asking for is access to material that should be public information.
Right. Well, this has been J.C. Meyer talking with Brian Lindstrom about his new film, Alien Boy, about the story of James Chassie, who died in September of 06 at the hands of Portland police. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Jay.
We'll be right back.